Please be seated. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Anadarko versus Thompson.
Please the court, Mr. David Gunn will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, may it please the court. 66 years ago, the gas lease that is in dispute in this case was executed, and the result within 2 or 3 weeks was a well that has been so successful that it has now outlived pieces of the aging pipeline system. Some repairs were done because of old acetylene torch welds that did not hold up particularly well at the joints over a long period of time. Those repairs were done in the early 1980s, in 81 and 85. 10 years later, after brief stoppages of production associated with those repairs, the plaintiffs wrote to us and complained about inactivity on the lease. We spent $250,000 drilling a second well, and it produced and has been producing up until now. The trial court found terminations of the lease in either 81 or 85, and the Court of Appeals confirmed.
When was the second well drilled?
The second well was drilled in 1995. And that led to the longest period of non-production in this case, which has been the court-permitted timeout while we litigate over title. But if you look at a 66-year period, the entirety of the lease from now back until 1936, the main well has produced, the leasehold has produced, everyone has done quite well. The threshold question is a somewhat quirky question of lease interpretation about a habendum clause which does not just hold the lease in force when gas is produced, but when gas is or can be.
Mr. Gunn, do you say the lease is ambiguous or unambiguous?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I say the best I can say is they didn't carry their burden to show it is unambiguous. It may well be.
Well, I'll put it a different way. Did your client assert anywhere below here that it was or was not, was ambiguous?
We did in our pleadings, Your Honor. We did.
So you said it was ambiguous in the trial court?
Yes. And
but has that changed your view?
No. As I understand the law of ambiguity and construing instruments, it is what it is regardless of pleadings. And if I say the cat is black, they say the cat is white, and the court says no, the cat is gray, then the cat is gray without pleadings. And your Coker versus Coker decision, I think, and White versus Moore from the 1980s establishes that. It may well be ambiguous. If it is, and we come back to latches at the end, that would lead to a dreadful trial of trying to determine the intent of the parties of a 1936 lease. This case and this lease may not be ambiguous, Justice Baker, but you will see cases that have an ambiguous document, and I don't know how you try that ambiguity.
Well, then, under your theory, I guess now, of it's not ambiguous,
right?
What do you say the habendum clause means?
I say it is a primitive form of a shut-in clause before shut-in clauses really took over, and that the parties probably thought about the nascent development of petroleum in the panhandle and the lack of pipeline facilities. And they, in fact, if you read later into paragraph 4, they contemplate the problem of hookup and getting to a pipeline later. So I say it means some sort of mechanical capability of production, not just geological presence of hydrocarbons in the ground, but that there's a well that can take the hydrocarbons out. Otherwise, the disjunctive is just gone. The or can be is gone.
Well, there's no question that this one is different than the habendum clause in the cases that were just argued.
Yes, it is. And you will not see many more like this. But the reason I wanted to start with it is, first, I think it actually is necessary for you to loop through this issue to get the right disposition of the case. Also, I am told there are a few others, and there's at least one other big is or can be lease with a monstrous amount of production at stake that's behind me in the judicial pipeline. If I might briefly go through the can be argument, then we can move to the broader jurisprudential issues. You know from Court of Appeals opinion that the Court of Appeals said we have to destroy the village to save it. We have to take out Horcanby to make this lease work. And that leads to problems, but they said that's just the best we can do. The Court of Appeals' primary objection, as I read it, was the infinity problem of a perpetual lease being held for speculation for all time. The answer to that is not only that it didn't happen, but that there are already tools in the law to stop that from happening. And those tools existed in 1936. Implied covenant to develop would provide the lessors with a damage suit against us. And if we continue to drag our feet and do nothing, not only could they get damages, they could get cancellation for an extreme set of facts. So implied covenant law is going to stop this hypothetical boogeyman that the Court of Appeals perceived. We have incentives. We want to produce, and we have a good track record of producing. I don't think the perpetual lease objection is very persuasive, given the presence of implied covenant law. The only speculation that was going on here was by the Court of Appeals. Nobody wants to hold on to this lease and just let it sit there. Second objection that the Court of Appeals raised was a surplusage objection. Now, I don't see that it makes any sense to say this part of the lease is surplusage, so I'm going to remove that part of the lease. They didn't really cure the surplusage problem. They just shifted and said the surplusage here is in the Abendum Clause rather than paragraphs 10 and 11. We read 10 and 11 not as surplusage, but as safe harbors, as savings clauses that simply allow an easy administrative way to prove non-termination. You can always do it the hard way. And maybe we could go through the factual proof of proving can be is satisfied. But why do that if I'm drilling a well, if my first well has gone dry, and I start within 60 days, start drilling a new well, I can just put somebody on the stand and say, I'm drilling this new well. I'm clear under paragraph 11. I think that is what is going on. It's just a safe harbor. 10 and 11 do not cause termination. 10, I should point out to you, paragraph 10 actually looks elsewhere for whether the lease is maintained or not. It refers in its text, it uses a phrase, while the lease is in force, which tells me it's pointing somewhere else. It contemplates, we know whether the lease is or is not enforced by looking at an earlier part of the document. 11, as I say, allows drilling of a second well if the first one runs out. And the plaintiff's reading of 10 and 11 would lead to some quirky results. For example, under paragraph 11, as I understand their reading, if there's just a one-day cessation on my first well, they've now triggered the 60-day requirement that I go out and drill another well when I may not need it. This is not an oil and gas lease. It's a gas lease, and it's in the nature of gas production to have temporary stoppages. You can't store the stuff is the problem. It's got to have a hookup and a pipeline. And this succeeded so well, so few of my documents live very long. But these drafters made a legal document that outlived the parties and kept on for a long time, and we hope will keep on for a long time in the future. This has produced very well, so well that the steel pipeline just had a breakdown and needed some help. The third and final objection that the Court of Appeals raised to the is or can be interpretation we proffer was a pair of out-of-state cases. The Oklahoma case, it comes from a different state with different law. They don't interpret habendum clauses the way we do. I have found a Louisiana case that appears to go our way. I will send you a letter with the citation to that. In that case, the trial court granted summary judgment on termination, said the lease was gone. The Court of Appeals reversed it and said, no, there are affidavits saying that gas can be produced. I just found it a couple of days ago, and I didn't want to sandbag anybody, so I'll send a letter to the court and opposing counsel. In short, we think this lease did not terminate, and the summary judgment, which found that it did, is erroneous and should be reversed. We have briefed, but I don't intend to argue the Clifton argument that you just heard. I have very little to add to that. The adverse possession and defensive issues I share in common, I would like to develop a little bit, because the knife that the plaintiffs bring down on the fee simple has two sides. It has a sharp edge, and if they really have the courage of their convictions and say that the fee simple determinable stops at some moment in time, then I say hold them to that position, like the judge in The Merchant of Venice and say, okay, you get what you asked for, and the clock started running. The trial court found me to be a trespasser. It found that we had been trespassing and exercising dominion over the minerals since the instant this lease terminated. If that is so, then I say St. Louis Royalty and the Fifth Circuit have long recognized the clock starts running. That is not the only adverse possession decision. It's well established that the way you possess minerals is by extracting them from the ground, and there's no question that's what we did. If we step back and look at the policy behind adverse possession, I can think of two or three policies, all of which are served by applying it here. First, the obvious policy of repose. Not repose for its own sake, but repose to protect people's investments from being destabilized by a stale claim where you don't know what the evidence is. Second,
do you agree with, is your view of the consequences of adverse possession the same as Mr. Pierce's? That is, you have 100% forever known?
I am not entirely clear. This court hasn't said. You have not. I think the oil and gas theologians get very upset about fine points of doctrine. And the problem with that is the history of oil and gas litigation is not theologically pure. I think the answer he gave you is the best answer. The statutory hook I would use is the phrase claim of right in the adverse possession statute. What is the claim that a producer is making when the lease maybe inadvertently terminates and they continue producing? They're not claiming to own everything and to exclude the royalty owners. They are claiming to go on with their share of the pie, the 7/8. That's exactly what the Fifth Circuit decreed. And they found
that. But don't you think his theory, in fact, gives the companies more than they ever had to start with?
In a way, it does.
Because it does away with the doctrine of fee simple determination. It doesn't determine the fee.
I think what it does away, not so much with that, because any.
Well, if you only had the right to 7/8 interest. So long as you produce gas or could be produced, and if you don't produce, you lose it.
Yes.
The argument that by adverse possession you get 7/8 fee simple, period, sounds to me like you get more than you ever had in the first place.
Well, it's only more in the sense that it doesn't have that trapdoor. You're correct, but it's not larger in scope.
Isn't that what your company bargained for in the first place?
Yes, and I have no objection if the court says, no, the best reading is to keep the lease alive. I don't object to that. I think the oil and gas theologians would say, well, it's
would
really
7/8. Would you call that a pre-termination status quo?
Yes. Yes, precisely right. It's sort of a statutory version of latches or some equitable defense. You're exactly right. The Fifth Circuit said, give the royalty owner his 1/8. He's got a right to an accounting. Don't shut him out completely. The claim of right is the way I think you ought to read it. What is the claim of right by the lessee? The claim that we're claiming under is the 7/8.
Well, in your lease, does the cessation of production clause cause the lease to terminate any time actual production ceases for more than 60 days?
No, it says just the opposite. It just says this is something that will not terminate the lease. It doesn't say, as the plaintiffs read it, the opposite. If you fail, if you get to 61 days, then the lease does terminate. It doesn't say that at all. The only thing that terminates the lease, I say, is the habendum clause. The development of the land, development of resources, is the social policy that I think is really behind the adverse possession statutes. The history of Texas and the frontier was characterized by very generous adverse possession statutes. And yes, it does result in a shifting of title. But that's what the legislature wanted.
So we're going to have the people that are going to the Railroad Commission letters switch over, and instead of going to the lessee, they'll be going to the lessor, saying, you need to argue that this lease terminated 60 years ago so you can now claim.
I think it would certainly put an end to the former industry of volunteer title examination. You're right.
No, they just switch over.
Well, that may be in the nature of adverse possession. And I agree, I'd rather find a little more equitable middle ground. If you go with me on is or can be, then the guilt is not mine for that development. But I'm afraid that is in the nature of it.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
I'm troubled all of the equitable issues that were raised in the earlier argument, it seems to me, presupposes that the lessor has some sort of, for the lessor to take advantage of the fee determinable, the reverter there, they have an affirmative obligation to step forward and assert their right. It seems to me to impose some sort of equitable defense against them. You have to point to a failure on their part to have asserted their interest under the reverter. Is there any law out there that says when you have fee determinable that it doesn't occur unless the original fee owner steps forward and stands on a soapbox proclaiming I now have title, or goes out on the property and shoos people away or something? Is there any sort of case law that says there's an obligation to do that for the reverter to work?
The closest two cases I'll give you. One is in the briefs, one is not. One is the Benavides versus Warren case from San Antonio. It's an early 80s NRE case that flat out applied latches to termination of a fee simple determinable. It was technically a royalty deed instead of a lease, but that case did it. The way I trace all of these equitable inroads, which...
But did Benavides identify some sort of obligation on the part of the person claiming the reverted title that they failed to, some sort of threshold or they had to do in order to get the title?
No. A fee simple determinable is an automatic transmission. It shifts without human conduct.
So
it just shifts.
But without some obligation on the part of the person getting title to do something, what is it that you predicate their having failed to have done that for a long period of time now keeps them from doing that? I mean, how do you measure the period of time that they have now done something or failed to do if there was never anything they had to do to begin with?
The thing that's unique about the fee simple determinable is that somebody has to prove a fact. And I think it fits reasonably well, although not perfectly, to let equity have a role in saying, if it's proof of a fact that you have to do to establish your title, not to get it in theory, but to actually go establish it at the courthouse, that the passage of time can have a bearing on that and
so
the deterioration
of reverter. There's not an automatic reverter, because until that fact is proved, there is no reverter of title.
I would just separate the substance and the procedure. Substantively, there is a theoretical reversion, but we've got to live in a practical world.
Wouldn't we really be saying we don't know what the facts are, we're not going to let anybody prove them up one way or the other?
It's something like that, yes. I think that's right. If it's unfair to change the status quo, if I've got record title and I've been producing for 66 years, and then somebody comes in and says, this terminated during World War II, and I can't prove it, and I had check records, but the savings and loan crisis has taken down all the banks that had the checks, and my predecessor in title, I can't find the records. There is something, stale demand, I think, could reach that.
So we could have one case where the event happened 50 or 60 years ago, but it just so happens we have good records on it.
Yes.
Or somebody kept a diary.
Yes.
And another case could be 10 years ago, and it would come out the other way.
That's correct. And it would be doctrinally pure to say we won't let equity do any of this, but we've crossed that Rubicon long ago with the equitable cases, not just Humble and Harrison, but the late delay rental cases, all of those. My favorite case is Kothman against Bailey from 1957. That's the reason we're not producing today. We're standing here still. The longest period of non-production is because your decisions say that if there's lessor repudiation and the lessor padlocks you out and says, you don't have title anymore, it reverted to me 3 weeks ago. Your decision says that is an estoppel and you can go to the courthouse and litigate. That rule just cannot coexist with the plaintiff's absolute view of a fee simple determinable. We've already crossed the equitable bridge. There's no reason not to adjust it to fit this pattern.
You've abandoned the estoppel defense, is that right? Has it been brought up here?
It's not equitable estoppel. I think it's quasi-estoppel.
Quasi-estoppel,
yes.
I guess, is what it was called in the Court of Appeals opinion.
Right. I didn't mean to abandon it. I think it's alive.
Okay, well, I mean, is the theory that you just talked with us about really the quasi-estoppel theory, or is it laches? What would you characterize it as, a legal theory?
Well, it's both. Quasi-estoppel, I think, is coming primarily from their letter where they complained to us, hey, you're not doing anything, give me the lease, and we drilled. The laches really is the one that goes back before that. And it's just, without them taking activity, both sides just sitting still and the evidence wasted away.
Your reference to a theoretical reverter at the point in time there was a cessation of production, is that new, or do you know anything in real property law that really talks about the reverter not actually happening until it's been proved up?
No, well, if we're talking fee simple determinable,
right,
or fee simple on condition subsequent?
No, fee simple determinable.
Okay. In a fee simple determinable, it just seems to me it's in the nature of having a court system. I don't know of a case that says it, but if you have to prove it, plaintiff comes in and doesn't answer interrogatories, and all the witnesses are struck, then they lose title, but yet in theory they've had it.
My question is, are you asking us to turn real property law on its head by saying that the reverter really doesn't occur until it's been proved, or is that consistent with Hornbook real property law?
I don't mean to ask you to turn it on its head. I really don't.
No, I understand you don't mean to. I'm just trying to get the lay of the land with how your argument fits.
My argument, I think that is consistent. If you have to prove facts before you can say what they were, you know, is Schrodinger's cat in the box dead or not? We don't know until we look. It just seems to me that's in the nature of having an adjudicative system.
Well, if I take title to property by adverse possession, that too is a fact-intensive inquiry.
Yes.
Do I not get the title until I go to the courthouse and prove it, or is my title effective when the 10 years runs under the statute? Do I take title from that day, or do I take title from the day I prove it at the courthouse?
I think you technically have it when the time runs, but nobody will lend you money and so on. You can't do anything with it until you prove it.
It seems to me the equitable doctrines are of less importance if you buy the theory that the plaintiff must prove more cessation of production in paying quantities in order to establish the reverter in the first place. Because that will shift the difficulty of getting information to the plaintiff rather than to the defendant.
I think that is true, but it's not clear. You know, Justice Enoch asked in the last question, who has the burden? And I think that really, it could be either side. It's not clear to me who has the burden. If one side comes in and trespasses to try title against the other, the plaintiff, whoever got there first, I believe, has the burden. So I'm not sure it shifts necessarily to the lessor in all cases, but you're correct.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Joe Lovell will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court. This court and several other courts were struggling with these same issues early in the last century, and a decision was made nearly 100 years ago that the language "so long thereafter as" created a determinable fee estate, and the parties have been contracting based upon that construction ever since. The arguments made by the gas companies in both of the cases you've heard today do turn that on its head, whether it's by applying the production in paying quantities reasonably prudent operator standard or the other proposals. If a landowner has to prove by the standard of a reasonably prudent operator, that means that landowner never gets title to their reversion back until they go in, file a lawsuit, and take action to do it. Now, when that is what has to be done to get the reversion back, that's not a fee simple determinable. That is
I don't understand that, because it looks to me like you could be sitting there in your home thinking, you know, I didn't get a check last month, so I own it.
That's right.
And then you're sitting there thinking, well, I own it. And then, lo and behold, the check comes in. It was lost in the mail. And then you say, well, now I don't own it. Don't you have to wait until the fact is proven one way or the other before you really know whether the reverter triggered or not?
Not to trigger the reverter. Perhaps you do to actually regain possession.
Well, but if you just imagine it, you don't own it. I mean, if you don't get the check, you don't really have the title. You don't really know whether you do or not. Is that right or not?
You don't know whether you do or not. That's correct. And that is the nature of the determinable fee estate.
But you don't know whether you do or not.
That's right. It doesn't matter.
When will you know?
I'm sorry?
When do you know?
That's going to depend on the facts of each case.
Yeah.
But they have to be litigated. It may turn out that either there was a reverter or not. It would have been effective whenever it occurred. But the lawsuit is to determine the facts. Did it happen or not? And to say that we're just not going to let you litigate the facts is not necessarily undo the doctrine, is it? We just simply say we're not going to let you. Since neither side has full possession of the facts, we're going to foreclose anybody from litigating that factual inquiry.
It's not a question of foreclosing people from litigating the factual inquiry. It's a question of the actual operation of that estate in land. And the actual operation is it happens automatically on the limitation that was set forth
depending
in the contract.
Depending on facts, though. We have to know what the facts were to determine if there was a reverter or not. And we don't have, if both sides aren't in full possession of all the facts, and we say, well, because both sides are not, because of the lapse of time, we're not going to let you delve into whether there was a reverter or not when it's a factual inquiry.
Which is a little bit different than the question of whether or not there was a reverter.
Now, if the reverters turn on facts, I mean, it just doesn't.
Sure, it turns. Right, it turns on the facts.
And you have to know what the facts were to determine if there was a reverter.
To know that, yes, ma'am.
Yes. And if we simply say we're just not going to let you get into that argument and thrash out what the facts were, that's not derogating the doctrine. We're just simply saying we're not going to let you prove it one way or the other.
I think it goes further than that, Your Honor, just because of the very nature of the property estate itself. And one of the problems with all of this and the way it's been brought up, in my mind anyway, is the fact that all of these problems are and have been easily resolved for many years simply through contracting of the parties. We have shut-in clauses. We have cessation production clauses like this lease has. We have force majeure clauses. And they're common, and there's nothing to prevent even NGPL, if it goes back, actually it was 40 years instead of 60 they're talking about, but there was nothing to prevent them from picking up the phone and getting an amendment to the lease or a ratification or a new lease. And that case actually that's before you provides the perfect example of why that should not happen, because they did know at least 20 years ago that the title had reverted and made the conscious decision to keep it a secret. And now Mr. Pierce stands up here and says, King's X, we have adversely possessed you secretly, and we have more than what we started out with. We have 7/8, and we don't have, there's no longer a right of reverter. That right of reverter is a valuable property right that those original landowners negotiated for and are entitled to pass on to their heirs.
I'm a little bit troubled about the reverter. There, if a fact occurs, there's a reverter. And the fact here is the cessation of production.
Yes, sir.
That's in dispute. The party's now disputed. Who has the burden to prove in the course of this dispute that there was a cessation of production?
Initially, the landowner does.
And
the
argument about latches, the title's already reverted. What happens with latches? If the landowner has the burden to approve the cessation, then can latches be used against the landowner when, although the landowner over the course of 40 years, the landowner now may be able to come forward and prove the threshold cessation. But the defendant has now lost all the evidence that they would have to have in order to meet that proof. So one party can still bring their case, but the other party, because of passage of time has occurred, no longer has their evidence. Why wouldn't, if the plaintiff has the burden to prove the threshold fact that caused the reverter, wouldn't it be appropriate for latches to apply if the plaintiff, if the lessor fails to assert that fact at a time that the defendant would have been able to meet that proof?
It depends. Actually, you could have the same problem in an adverse possession case, but that doesn't change title. Now, one of the reasons that latches should not, I mean it doesn't, but one of the reasons that it should not in this context is because who has control over the facts that tell what happened? Well, it's going to be the producer. And if we grant to them the opportunity to say, okay, we're going to place the burden of proof on this party who has a right of reverter to prove what you, operator, did or did not do when, then that creates the incentive to act just like NGPL acted, and that is start destroying records that implicate themselves. And then you've left the landowner without any means of showing that their property right has reverted to them. Now, they've made it sound today like such an onerous burden to prove what happened with the well. But the facts in the cases before you contradict that argument. These companies have well files that are contained within the record that they show checks, delay rental checks, from the turn of the century. Yet they destroy other files that they say, well, they show what we were doing and why we were doing it. Yet we have lease files that contain documents going back forever. They keep in their record retention policy, they keep those documents which are important to show the state of their title.
Mr. Lovell, would you explain why the Court of Appeals did not read out of the habendum clause the or can be produced language?
They didn't read it out. When applicable lease construction principles are applied, you can't just read three words. You have to read four corners of the document.
If you do that, it says, so as long thereafter as gas is or can be produced.
Right.
Mr. Gunn has addressed that argument to say we must give meaning to all of those words, and which gives meaning to the entirety of the lease.
That's correct.
What's your response?
The document itself. In the first place, how that is to be construed is the courts are to construe searching for the intent of the parties. And in this document, the intent of the parties is given to us in paragraph 1, where it says the purpose of this lease is for producing gas, not discovering and holding gas, but for producing gas. Then we have the paragraph 2 habendum clause, is or can be produced. Then it goes on, though. There's a commencement clause that requires, in spite of the one-year primary term, requires that drilling be commenced in a very short period of time. And this one, 14 days, 14 or 15 days, I think, that they have to commence. Then it goes on, this continuation in paragraph 4, and it says, upon completion of said well as a well producing natural gas in paying quantities, lessee shall, within 60 days, cause that well to be connected to a pipeline and commence producing and marketing. Okay? Then we have the paragraph 10 and paragraph 11, these savings provisions, which, again, belie the claim that is or can be produced means to the operator whenever we get around to it. Paragraph 10, interestingly, says notwithstanding anything in this lease contained to the contrary, it is expressly agreed that if lessee shall commence drilling operations at any time while this lease is in force, which occurred, this lease shall remain in force and its term shall continue so long as such operations are prosecuted, and if production results therefrom, then as long as production continues. And that's precisely what happened.
And Mr. Gunn's response to that is that the additional language in the habendum clause operates as a shut-in clause, which would be consistent with everything you just talked about.
The additional language in the abendum clause is not a shut-in clause. If there's a shut-in clause...
I'm just saying, his response is that he can read it consistently by giving it that kind of meaning, all the clauses that you talked about.
Yet how does construing that as a shut-in clause fit within the intent of the parties to encourage production and fit within the language of the numerous cases out of this and other courts saying that courts will construe leases to require production? It doesn't fit, and it is not a reasonable interpretation. This case is controlled ultimately by paragraph 11, which says, if this production on the lease premises shall cease from any cause, this lease shall not terminate it, provided. And then it gives 60 days to regain production. And in this case, there were two periods in excess of 60 days. By the way, I do need to correct a misstatement of the facts that you heard. There was no evidence of any activities or any pipeline problems or anything else with respect to the 1985 cessation, which was at least 91 days. Further, while I'm thinking about it, no party has claimed that this lease is ambiguous, not here, not in the Court of Appeals, not the trial court. So, when you look at the four corners of the document, this one is pretty clear that can be does not mean a shut-in clause. Now, there's other cases that this court has construed that language, is or can be produced. And one of them is one of the leading oil and gas cases, the Texas Company versus Davis. That had a can be produced habendum clause. And this court determined that required production. So it's easily construed to deal with that. I'd like to touch on adverse possession. In the first place, before I get too far, I do want to remind the court that in this case, ultimately adverse possession, that defense turns on the facts. Here, the trial court it was a bench trial. The trial court found against Anadarko on its claims of adverse possession, found it had not met its burden of proof. But the elements that are raised here are the elements of intent and notice of repudiation. Now, notice of repudiation is really the critical thing, and particularly in light of the argument we heard in the last case. That is exactly why there has to be notice of repudiation, is so that people have noticed that somebody is claiming title by possession. And the cases go back well over 100 years that require that in a circumstance such as we have here, where possession commences permissively, before that possession can start triggering a limitations title, there has to be notice of repudiation of the previously permissive tenancy. And that's also set forth in the definition of adverse possession itself, which requires an actual and visible appropriation of real property commenced and continued under a claim of right that is inconsistent with and hostile to the claim of the owner.
Can that notice be in the form of a failure to pay royalties that would otherwise be due during production?
No, not necessarily. Under certain facts, I guess it could be. But that, then if they start up royalties again, that's conduct that's consistent with the leasehold estate. Just like actually being out there and producing, putting wells on, putting signs at the well sites, those are all activities that are consistent with the previously permissive character.
Well, if their adverse possession claim is only to 7/8, then would that necessarily be inconsistent so long as they paid royalties on 1/8 and just paid it whether or not they had a cessation longer than 60 days?
If I understand your question, yes, that is still inconsistent because even though they may be claiming only 7/8, they're claiming 7/8 fee simple title and taking away any right of reverter.
But you couldn't tell that
from the payment. The payment would look the same.
That's
regardless
right.
of their claim on the work.
Exactly, which is exactly why it wouldn't provide notice and would be consistent with the previously permissive estate.
But why is it notice that they're at least claiming what they had before with the right of work?
They are claiming it through the lease, which is the permissive possession.
But you claim that's gone away.
That's right. And that.
So what are they doing on your property?
They're producing.
I have trouble with.
They're producing the well. Now,
under what claim of right? They're keeping a bunch of them.
It depends on what claim of right they make, Your Honor. Because.
Well, I mean, if somebody came on the property, my property, started drilling a well, carrying off all the goodies, I would be upset about why. I would want to know, why are you out there?
Sure, but if they were out there to begin with because you gave them a piece of paper that gave them permission to be out there,
right.
then you have no way of knowing that they're now claiming title to your property because they're out there.
But if you gave them the paper, and everything goes along hunky-dory for 20 years, and they pay you an eighth, and then all of a sudden there's 3 months they don't pay you, which is notice to you that it's now your property under your reading of the lease, and then they start paying you that eighth again, isn't that open and notorious occupation of the land or whatever the standard of the applicable adverse possession statute?
No, Your Honor, because that, once again, that is consistent with the previous possession and...
But you say the previous possession is now in the past, that they don't have any current possession.
No, that they don't have current title. They still have possession. They don't have title. And that's the difference.
Then they should be sending you more... profit, and they should only be keeping their cost of operation.
That's right. But
so the fact that your royalty payment hasn't gone up and it's still calculated the same way would be notice.
No. We get down to the question of notice. What is notice and what is not notice, and what is consistent and what's not consistent, and how they started out. And if they start out permissively, just for example, you said, well, they miss a few months' payments, so automatically everybody knows that the lease terminated. Everybody doesn't know that the lease terminated. Everybody doesn't necessarily know that they missed several months' payments. And you can see that in the record that you have in this case. These landowners owned not just the royalties on one well, there were several wells. And they got one check for all these wells. And you can look at the
print at the bottom that tells you how it was calculated.
No. Look at them. I encourage the court to look at them. We had testimony from accountants who couldn't even figure out what all those numbers meant. Sometimes they didn't even refer to wells. They would refer to division order numbers that were internal to Anadarko. So getting
so
a check or not.
So if any would come from diving down to Austin and looking at the Railroad Commission records?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
So your notice, if any, would come from taking a trip to Austin and looking through Railroad Commission files?
That, it could, yes, that's right. Because that way, I mean, if you do that, you can find production history on a given well. That's correct. But the point is that a missing check is not necessarily notice of an adverse claim. Now, in this case, it's even easier to resolve because here, Anadarko's own representative admitted that they weren't claiming possessively, only claiming under the lease. In fact, they moved off the property. They took off the compressor, they shut down the well, they chained it up and left when the suit was filed, which is clear evidence that they didn't consider themselves to have limitations title. It's for these reasons we ask the court to affirm.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Judge Baker,
I'll answer your question. Ambiguity you'll find on page 173. In our answer of the 173 of the clerk's record. Our possession was not permissive. We use the word lease. We're not a tenant. We own fee simple the terminable. We're either the owner, not there by permission, but by our right, or we're a trespasser, which is what finding number 12 found us to be. I think the court understands the issues. If you have no further questions, I'll return the balance of my time.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
And that concludes the argument in the second clause of the court.
All rise.